All right. So thank you all for joining us for this this panel on From Efficacy to Effectiveness. We're really very, very pleased and feeling very fortunate to have with us here two very distinguished researchers who've both made significant contributions to the field and both are really outstanding models of productive, thoughtful, programmatic research career paths in interventions research. Our panelists include Dr. Esther Deblinger from the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey and Dr. Greg Clark from the Center for Health Research at Kaiser Foundation Hospitals. Both of these folks span, their careers in a way span efficacy through effectiveness. Dr. Deblinger's presentation, I think, will focus a little bit more on the efficacy end, and Dr. Clark's will focus a little bit more on his more recent work that has spanned out into effectiveness and services research. So in a way, they represent the full range, and I think their presentations will be complementary in a good way. In keeping with the sort of overall format that we've had for this workshop, we want to allow time for and we want to encourage discussion and interaction among the participants here. So we've asked each of our presenters to spend about 20 or so minutes on their presentation. We'll leave plenty of time for discussion and questions. And we've asked them to discuss sort of scientific highlights of their work that illustrate their programs, but also highlight various career-relevant issues along the way that investigators pursuing research interventions would probably find interesting and compelling. So again, we'll have plenty of time for questions and discussion. With that, we'll start with Dr. Deblinger's presentation. Dr. Deblinger's program of research is centered around the development and testing of interventions for children with PTSD and other problems secondary to victimization. So most of you are probably familiar with her research and her intervention, trauma-focused CBT. And her program of research very nicely illustrates extremely thoughtful course of intervention research that spans from treatment development, including the initial identification of intervention targets and strategies, to initial efficacy testing, to larger scale efficacy testing, to moving on to examining important theoretical and practical questions around dose and parametric studies and active components in dismantling-like designs. And her more recent work has sort of expanded to include different translational directions to include some early work incorporating various basic cognitive measures to understand mechanisms and some work in another direction to sort of incorporate services-relevant questions as we begin to move evidence-based treatments out into real practice settings. So with all of that said, Dr. Deblinger.
Good afternoon. First, I have to thank Joel and wish you all to have the good fortune of having as supportive a program officer as I have. I thought that it might be useful for me to share a little bit about the development of my career, thinking that many of you are at the stage of your careers where I was about 17, 18 years ago. And the first thing that I thought I would share is how I chose a field of study. It was a sort of an odd way to develop expertise. I was a psychology intern about 18 years ago, and I happened to be originally from New York, but I was at my internship in Philadelphia at the Medical College of Pennsylvania and made the decision that Philadelphia was a more reasonable place to live. And I began to look for a position. And there at the Medical College of Pennsylvania, I was actually offered a position by Dr. Ellen Belak, who was the director of adult psychiatry at the time. And he suggested that I take a position with him, working with families of schizophrenics. And I thought to myself, well, that is a very interesting field. I had some experience in that field, but it wasn't where my passion was. So I thanked him very much for that offer, and I expressed to him that for my first job, I was really hoping to get a position working with children. That's what I had hoped to do throughout my graduate training. And he was kind enough to go to the chair of child psychiatry and express to her, it was Dr. Susan McClear at the time, that there was a psychology intern graduating who was very interested in a position working with children. Were there any openings in child psychiatry? And apparently she said to him, well, we have a position for the co-director of the newly opening Child Sexual Abuse Diagnostic and Treatment Center. Is she interested in child sexual abuse? And apparently he said, yes. And literally, that's how I chose my field of study. And I have to tell you that although it was serendipitous, it has been a fascinating journey for me for a variety of reasons and an excellent choice in terms of an area of research study. One of the reasons for that is that at the time, 18 years ago, the literature on child sexual abuse was actually pretty dense in terms of assessment research. We knew a lot about children who'd suffered sexual abuse. We knew that they experienced many, many different kinds of psychiatric difficulties, including substance abuse, risky sexual behavior, interpersonal difficulties, re-victimization, suicide risk. The literature was quite expansive, and it continues to expand. To this day, every month I see a new article in one journal or another indicating the impact of sexual abuse on child, adolescent, and adult functioning. So it was very clear to me, even 18 years ago, that this was a field in which children really needed assistance. What I also discovered in the early days was that there was absolutely no empirical literature. None. There were a lot of very, very interesting things written about treating children who'd been sexually abused, but there was not one single study evaluating the effectiveness of these treatment approaches. And so it turned out to be a field that was in some sense wide open. And I'm emphasizing that to you because I think that really helped me in my career. And I think that if you are not just falling into something as I did, but actually choosing a field, it often helps to look at a field where there is a great need and not to fear fields like child sexual abuse where there are difficulties in terms of the system that you're working in. I can tell you that although it is a struggle at times working with child protection, working with lawyers and judges, it does not make research impossible. In fact, it makes research in some ways a lot more stimulating, and you have an opportunity to work to learn from colleagues from a variety of different disciplines. So I really would encourage and support researchers to pursue research in the area of child abuse and neglect. So as you can imagine, early in my career, I took on this position, co-director of the Child Sexual Abuse Diagnostic and Treatment Center, and I certainly felt like an imposter because I knew very little about the field. So the first thing I felt we needed to do as a clinic was assessment research. Although there was a lot of research in the literature, I needed to know about the children presenting at our clinic. And in those early days, we did a couple of very simple studies using structured diagnostic interviews, and we determined that the most common diagnosis for children who had suffered sexual abuse was post-traumatic stress disorder. Many children also had problems with depression and significant behavior problems, but that helped to focus our research efforts by identifying post-traumatic stress disorder. We also looked at symptoms that were unique to children who've been sexually abused so that when we were developing our treatment model that was going to target PTSD in these children, we also understood, were there special things about these children that we needed to pay particular attention to? And in one study, we documented that, in fact, age-inappropriate sexual behaviors was something that we really needed to develop a component to address. Then finally, we did studies looking at the moms. And these studies were, I think, very, very important, particularly because there's a very sort of pejorative attitude oftentimes to mothers of children who've been sexually abused that I felt we needed to either confirm with research or dispute. And I have spent much of my career disputing the clinical literature that has been so negative towards not offending mothers. So with this assessment research, we began to build a treatment model. And I had the very good fortune of working alongside Dr. Edna Foa, who was doing research with adult rape victims. And in fact, we developed a treatment model that was based on her work and her experience with adults, although it was modified very significantly to accommodate children's needs and to incorporate parents in the treatment itself. So we began with just simple pre-post studies. The very first study was an individual treatment study where we looked at only 19 girls, but in that study we learned something very important. We learned that our treatment model seemed to be very helpful in helping these girls overcome PTSD and behavior problems, but we weren't satisfied with their improvement in terms of depression. So we went back to the treatment model and we tweaked it. We incorporated more cognitive therapy interventions to specifically to target depressive symptoms. We also immediately started to develop a huge waiting list, and this is where the practical aspects of doing research in a real-life setting comes into play. We recognized that in order to see large numbers of children, maybe it would be valuable to do groups. So our next pilot study was a group study where we used the same treatment model, but instead of applying it in an individual therapy format, we applied it in a group therapy format with very similar positive results. Interestingly, what we learned from this study was that it was a study for very young children, preschoolers, and we ended up not using exposure because of the group format. We compared a supportive approach to a trauma-focused CBT approach, but minus the exposure, we didn't see great differences between the two conditions. So our conclusion was perhaps it was the exposure piece that led to the lack of differences on PTSD. Now, there were some other differences. We did see differences in the mothers who were in the trauma-focused CBT group, and in fact did more exposure. They did show greater improvements in terms of their personal abuse-specific distress. And children in the CBT program also showed greater improvements in terms of their body safety skills. With that pilot data in hand, we began to apply for randomized controlled trial funding. And during that period of time, we did some interesting studies looking at the components of the treatment model that we had developed and again learned some very important things. Like always building on the idea of what is working in this treatment model, what is not working. And what we learned in our first randomized controlled trial was that the parent component of treatment was particularly important in helping children overcome behavior problems and depression. But it turned out that the parent component was not particularly critical in helping children overcome PTSD. In fact, children really needed to work closely with the professional therapist to overcome PTSD. Actually, that made a lot of clinical sense to us because many parents whose children have been recently sexually abused are suffering PTSD themselves. And so it's very difficult to help their children overcome their own post-traumatic stress. Another very important thing happened during that period of time when I was working on that dismantling study. I happened to meet some colleagues, Judith Cohen and Anthony Manarino, at a meeting very similar to this, where the funding agency, it was the National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect, brought us together. And we recognized that we were both testing treatment models that were very, very similar. And we decided that it made more sense for us to work together than for us to sort of simultaneously work in parallel on very similar models. And in fact, we've had a very successful collaboration since then. It has allowed us to not only continue our research, but to look at different variables because our numbers are now larger. When we do a study, we have twice the number of subjects in our investigations. Over the course of the time, we've, of course, did follow-up studies. One follow-up was 2 years, and we found the children's improvements that we identified at post-treatment, in fact, maintained at a 2-year follow-up. Cohen and Manarino had similar findings where they also found at 1-year follow-up many of these symptom improvements had been maintained. And our most recent collaboration is still the only multi-site study in the field, which we're particularly proud of. And it included 8 to 14-year-olds and was a simple design comparing supportive non-directive therapy to our model that we collaborated on, which we today call trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. A couple of things I want to share with you about the the importance of identifying the type of treatment model you want to examine. Now, clearly, our treatment model is based on our own research and research of others, like Edna Foa, and very basic research that we believe influences the development of this model. But the other treatment model also has important validity in the sense that we looked at what clinicians were doing in the community. What we found was most clinicians were doing supportive counseling, generally in a fairly client-centered manner. And so we chose that as our alternative treatment approach to compare TFCBT to. We started out with 229 children, the majority of which in this case were female, fairly diverse sample. A very important aspect of the sample that I want to emphasize is that this was a diverse sample in terms of traumas. Our identified trauma was sexual abuse. All the children had an experience of sexual abuse. But oftentimes, when we do efficacy research, we're sort of accused of having pristine samples. And I want to emphasize that we had minimum exclusion criteria and that almost all the children were referred from child protection. So essentially, we were seeing the same children that people see in the community. They happened to be enrolled in a randomized controlled trial and at an academic setting, but they are the same children with all of the difficulties that children have who are being seen in community agencies. The results were pretty striking. First and most important, I want to emphasize that children improved across both conditions. Sometimes we don't emphasize that when you're doing randomized controlled trials because we're really interested in the differences. But I think it's very important to pay attention to that. And the reason it's important is both because it's helpful to know that kids are getting better, regardless of the intervention, but it also explains clinicians' enthusiasm about a different type of treatment. It explains clinicians' enthusiasm about supportive, client-centered approaches. You can't say to clinicians that doesn't work. They recognize that it does work. They recognize that the kids that they're seeing are getting better and feeling better. And in fact, our research documents that, and we always emphasize that. However, we did also see somewhat greater improvements, significantly greater improvements, for children who were randomly assigned to trauma-focused CBT. And that demonstrated itself in terms of PTSD, depression, behavior problems, shame, which is an important variable that we're beginning to examine, and perceived credibility. In terms of PTSD diagnosis, children overcame PTSD much more rapidly in response to trauma-focused CBT, so that 79% of children no longer met criteria for PTSD as compared to 54%. Parents also demonstrated greater improvements with respect to trauma-focused CBT. And I think I reviewed these findings. So I want to just quickly take a few minutes to tell you about the treatment model. It is a hybrid model, and it incorporates work with the child, with the parent, with the ultimate goal of working with the child and the parent together, although we start out separately. And again, the reason we start out separately is because parents are usually suffering themselves. And so we need to help parents cope more effectively before they could be effective coping role models for their children. Another thing that's very important to emphasize about the model is that it is manualized, but when I talk with clinicians and I train people on this treatment model, I don't emphasize that. In order to do the research, we must have a manual. But sometimes community clinicians think that that undermines their creativity, that a manual interferes with their clinical judgment. And we really want to discourage that belief because it is not at all true. And as I go through, you'll recognize that. We also, of course, emphasize that we are respectful of cultural and family values. In the field of sexual abuse, you're dealing with a lot of sensitive issues, and so you have to be aware that people have different views. And of course, the therapeutic relationship is central. And again, this is particularly important when you're thinking about going from efficacy to effectiveness research. When you'll be working with clinicians in the community, you want to be aware that we tend to talk about the manual, the structure, the skills, the techniques, and we forget to talk about the therapeutic relationship. I think that's an error that we make, particularly as cognitive behavioral therapists, because therapists in the community recognize that that is critical to motivating clients to do homework, to pick up skills, to try things that that can sometimes be particularly difficult for children and parents. Just quickly, some of the components of this treatment model include psychoeducation, relaxation, affect expression and regulation, cognitive coping, trauma narrative and development and processing, in vivo gradual exposure, conjoined parent-child sessions, and enhancing safety and future development. And it all happens to spell PRACTICE, which is an acronym that we particularly like because it focuses on the idea that the process is one that requires a great deal of practice in session and at home. The initial treatment components focus on psychoeducation and parenting skills, skill building, as I said. What we think is one of the most central components of treatment is the work on discussing the trauma directly. And we're actually doing a study right now where we're looking at whether that's essential. Because it turns out that many clinicians in the community, even if a child is presenting with the problem being a history of exposure to domestic violence or sexual abuse or other recent traumas, don't necessarily directly take on the trauma. And I'll give you one example. Over 10 years ago, I was referred a little boy who was being seen by a therapist in the community for about a year. He was originally referred because he had been sexually abused, but he had very severe behavior problems. And the therapist in the community worked with him for a year, was really struggling with him, and she and the mom were concerned that his behavior problems were becoming more severe. And she happened to know that I was a cognitive behavioral therapist, and she thought maybe I could be more effective with him. So she referred him to me, which is, I think, really commendable as a therapist to recognize certain limits and suggest an alternative. And because we were working in a very structured manner, the second session, I asked this little boy, tell me, how much did you talk to your previous therapist about the sexual abuse? And this little boy looked at me and he said, oh no, we didn't talk about that. And I said, no. And he said, not at all. And I said, really? How come? And he looked at me and he said, she wasn't ready. And I share that frequently because I think that we do have to take the lead when we're working with children. And children follow our lead. They watch very closely what we say and what we do. And inadvertently, we may give children the impression that we don't feel they are capable of talking about something painful or traumatic. So this is actually the component of treatment that we are now looking at more closely to better understand, is it an essential ingredient? Because it is uncomfortable for the kids at times, it's uncomfortable for the parents, and apparently it is uncomfortable for clinicians to think that you might be doing something or encouraging something that can be upsetting to children. Clearly, we all go into this field because we want to help children. And so it's natural for clinicians to not want to necessarily do something that is anxiety provoking. And it certainly is at times anxiety provoking for children to talk about their trauma or write about their trauma. Ultimately, however, many of the kids who we see in this treatment model do very, very well in talking, writing, and drawing about their experiences. And they do it in a variety of different, very creative ways. This was a little girl who, with a simple piece of paper and a pencil, drew about her experience. A more sophisticated drawing by an older child. A poem. Some children are creative through poetry. And this little girl wrote, after the sexual abuse, we went to see Marion and Esther, sweet as can be, with smiles and hellos, hugs to start our day, our troubles they would hear showing us the way. No more anger, no more fear, gone is the pain because of my counselor dear. Obviously my favorite poem. Just about every child that comes to see us and receives trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy actually writes a book about their experience. And each of these books are dramatically different and are extraordinarily creative. This little girl was so creative that when she wrote her book, she titled it, Did It Really Happen?, which I think is very meaningful because this child was not believed initially. And of course, it's subtitled based on a true story. And then she ended her book to make sure whoever read it in great detail with a little true-false question and answer sheet. Once children have begun to effectively talk about their experience, we actually also have them process much of what they've written in their narrative. And we process feelings, we process attributions for the abuse, we process how they think about their relationships, how they think about sexuality, how they think about their reaction of others. Oftentimes, the initial reaction to a child disclosing is very negative, is very angry. And unfortunately, children internalize that. The anger may be directed to the offender, but young children don't necessarily recognize that. So all this comes through in the narrative, and we help them process it. A couple of things I want to emphasize. This has been a process that has been an incredible intellectual process and an incredibly exciting research process, but it also is one that I think has been greatly informed by clients and greatly informed by life. Those of you who are doing intervention research, who are doing therapy research, don't only focus on the data, because you're missing such an opportunity to learn a great deal from the children that you work with, the adults that you work with, and your things that you can learn in the course of your own life. It's all about helping people who are suffering. So don't hesitate to incorporate ideas that you gather outside of the research domain. And I'll give you just a couple of examples. One very important lesson I learned from a young client of mine was that when the going gets really tough, and she had full-blown PTSD and was highly, highly avoidant, one way that children are extraordinarily motivated is to suggest that instead of doing this to help yourself so that you should feel better, because kids aren't motivated by that well. Adults may be motivated. They recognize they want to start to feel better, but kids are not necessarily motivated by that self-interest of getting over depression or PTSD. But they are unbelievably motivated by compassion for other children. And so in doing trauma narrative work, sometimes we have found that suggesting to a child that you might be able to do a drawing or might be able to write a poster or a poem that might help other children, that can be extraordinarily motivating. And I'll give you one example. This young lady did a drawing, and we were able to create an art exhibit that actually travels from mall to mall in our community. And in fact, this particular drawing, we were able to get someone to donate a billboard. So on the Atlantic City Expressway, right after the McDonald's billboard, for about a year came this billboard. And you can imagine what a powerful impact it had on this particular child to know that her work was being used in this way. Another thing I'll share with you. If you have children in your life, learn from them as well. My own children taught me a lot about how to teach body safety skills. When my oldest was about 3, I recognized that we had been teaching parents as part of our work to tell their children early on what the names of the body parts are, particularly the private parts. That, it turns out, is something that we don't do as a society. We teach children all these crazy names for their private parts, and in doing so, we convey them a degree of embarrassment. That if, unfortunately, you have to tell someone that something has happened to you, most children not only don't have the words, but they also have the sense of embarrassment, because we make up words because we're so embarrassed to say penis, vagina, breasts. So when my daughter was 3, I decided this is what we preach, teach young children the proper terms for their private parts. And I said to my husband, you know what? It's time to teach our daughter the names of all of her body parts, not just head, shoulders, knees, and toes, but penis, breasts, and vagina. And of course, he said to me, do you have to bring your work home? So it took me a while to convince him, but I did convince him. And ultimately, I recognized that there were many other steps that needed to come after we taught her the names of the private parts. And in fact, quickly, I'll share with you that weekend, my parents came to visit, and they learned the names of the private parts. But I was thankful it wasn't my in-laws. But still, after teaching the names of the private parts, it's much more complex than that, helping a child understand about sexual abuse. So a colleague of mine and I decided that if we had difficulty explaining to our own children what child sexual abuse is and how to keep your body safe, then it certainly was difficult for our clients. So as part of this process, we developed a book that we incorporate to treatment every single time we work with children. And it has become a very important adjunct to treatment. Our final treatment component has to do with pulling parents and children in together to learn the skills, to practice the skills, but also to communicate about the trauma. And usually that starts out just by having a child share her trauma narrative. Opening that communication is extraordinarily powerful. So next steps. We've done a lot of work up until now, and I started to share with you my collaborative efforts with Judith Cohen and Tony Manarino continue, and we are beginning to look at critical components as well as dose effects. How much treatment do children need, depending on their age, depending on their symptom status at pretreatment? We're also beginning to apply this model to other populations, and I am having the wonderful experience of mentoring early investigators. Shannon Dorsey, for example, is applying trauma-focused CBT to children in foster care. Dana Smith is applying trauma-focused CBT to adolescents in the juvenile justice system. My colleague Michael De Ariano has modified trauma-focused CBT for Latino populations. And most importantly, my colleague Melissa Runyon, who is a fellow colleague at UMDNJ, is using a CBT approach, although it has similar components to trauma-focused CBT, but it's for children who've suffered physical abuse and their abusive parents. So it's really a distinct model, and we're working together on that. And the next step really for us is doing dissemination research, moving on to the effectiveness research. And I recognize that that is a scary step, because up until this point, I've hired all the clinicians. I have had a lot of influence and control over what happens. I've listened to many, 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 almost all the therapy tapes that we've, during the course of all these studies. And so the next step is going to be really challenging, and I look forward to particularly hearing Dr. Clark talk about it. But it is a critical, critical step. Finally, I want to share with you that we are working with Medical University of South Carolina to get the treatment approach out using the internet. It's a fabulous internet site that I encourage all of you to go to. It's free of charge, which makes it particularly appealing, and I think that it's the first step in getting out to the community. We've had hundreds and hundreds of people complete the website from all over the world, actually, and although it's not sufficient to learn this treatment model, it's a wonderful first step. Finally, I want to sort of build on some of my other colleagues who shared with you the issue of balancing. And to me, that is probably the biggest lesson that I've learned over the course of the last 18 years. That in order to continue to be excited about your work, in order to continue to be passionate about your work, it's extremely important to keep it balanced. And I've shared with you some of my thoughts on how to keep it balanced. But I'd like to just end with a story that maybe reflects some of how I've tried to keep it balanced over these years. As I mentioned, in the course of the last 18 years, I've had two children. And that has been the biggest balancing act for me, continuing the work and also giving what I want to give to my children. And I'll share with you, one evening, I was leaving for work. I have, for all these years, maintained some clinical involvement. And I have to tell you, as a researcher, if you're doing intervention research, I would strongly encourage you to do that, because it keeps you really in touch with the treatment approach. It helps you to train on the treatment approach. It helps to give you new ideas. It helps you to learn directly from the children. So I've always worked on Tuesday nights to see a family or do a group. That's been my night that I go back and I do clinical work. And one evening I said to my daughter, I've got to go back tonight to see some children. And she said to me, she was about 5 years old, "Why do you have to go out on Tuesday nights? Why?" And I said, "Well, you know, mommy has to help children who have problems." And she said to me, "But mommy, I have a problem." And I said, "Well, what's your problem, honey?" She said, "My mommy has to work on Tuesday nights." I said, "Well, you know, honey, we'll have dinner together and then I'll see you later on." She said, "Well, could you do somersaults with me and Sarah before you go?" And I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to be late. I have to eat dinner. I have to get back. This is definitely going to make me late, but I am Superwoman, so I'm going to do this. Even though I'm a little bit older as a mom and I had no idea how I was going to get my head to the floor to do the somersault, I thought, I have to do this. She asked me, I'm going back to work. So I said, okay, let's go. We'll do some somersaults in the family room. And so somehow I got myself down there to do the somersault. And as I was somersaulting over, my button popped off my pants. And I thought, okay, now I'm really going to be late. And I got a little frustrated. And I thought I was being a little short with her. And she was asking for another somersault. And I said, no more somersaults. Mommy has to go sew her button now. And I have to get back to work. I'm going to be late. And we quickly had a dinner. And then I left feeling terrible, feeling like I'm not doing the clinical, I'm not doing the research, I'm not doing the mom thing too well. And as I was walking out of the house, I said goodnight, kissed them both goodbye, and told them I would see them later. I overheard my little five-year-old say to my younger one, who was only three at the time, "Don't you just love mommy huge much?" And I thought, wow, let me hold on to that because I feel like I totally screwed up tonight. I'm going to be late. I was a little short with them. But I have actually used that in so many ways. I hold on to that. And I encourage you to have something that you hold on to help you keep perspective, to help you recognize the importance of your work, but balancing it with the other important things in your life. And the way I hold on to that is we always say, I love you huge much. It reminds me of that moment. It helps me keep it in perspective. We write it on cards. My daughter knows it's a quote from her, but she doesn't recognize how it all transpired that particular night. So I encourage you to pick a field that you're passionate about, pursue it to the utmost, throw yourself in intellectually, but keep it balanced and have fun.
Thanks very much, Esther. We'll perhaps hold questions until the